Session number 13265, reel number 21.
On reel 21.
And we went through the Australian Bight onto Sydney, but in the Bight we sailed the most enormous seas, huge swells, which I reckon must have been over a mile from crest to crest. Incredible height to them, and certainly big enough so that the ship had to drive its way up the slope, up the face slope, and then went down like a racehorse or like a racing boat down the other side. Sometimes where the swells were smaller, when we rode over the crest of the swell, the propellers would nearly come out of the water. And of course they would race, and then the whole rear end of the ship would shudder and rattle like crazy. And if that happened at night, the cabin we were in was far enough aft so that we were over the propellers and you could just about get shaken out of your bunk. I should say that by after Bombay, when I was the only raft type left aboard on the mess decks, I went up to join the New Zealand sergeants in the cabins, and from there on I travelled as though I were one of the sergeants, because the people down in the galley said, well, they weren't going to cook for just one corporal, and I just had to pretend to be a sergeant from then on, and go on into what had been the sergeant's mess, the sergeant's dining room. Since there were only three or four Australian aircrew sergeants and, as I say, four or five New Zealanders, they accepted it. Well, there were one or two of the older regular service types who were a bit sniffy, but most of them just put up with it. And that's how we went on from there. We pulled into Sydney eventually, and we had about a week ashore there, and we were taken in hand by one of the wartime organisations, you know, for looking after the troops. I think we were something to do with the Farmers Union or something of that order, and we were shared out amongst various members of this group. And the couple who looked after, I think, three or four of us, were quite a nice couple. The wife drove us around to see things. While the husband came home from work or at weekend. There was one weekend involved. He took us out too. So I got to see Taronga Park, the zoo there in Sydney Harbour, and so on. I can remember as we sailed into Sydney Harbour being intrigued by two Dornier 24s, which were hauled up in Mechanics Bay. The Dorniers, the Dutch Air Force had used Dorniers in the East Indies, and these were two which had come down through the East Indies ahead of the Japanese advance, and were still being used and flown by Dutch crews on submarine patrols and things of that order. Farther up the harbour, there was a forest of masts. We pulled into Dalgetty's Wharf, which was almost underneath our harbour bridge. The Aussies always call it our harbour bridge, or did then. And I was intrigued by these masts, because I could see clearly that this was a huge collection of schooners. There were two-masted, three-masted, four-masted, even seven-masted schooners laid up there, and by asking around I discovered that these were island schooners which had been in the copra trade and so on, and whatever else in the Solomons and the islands north of Australia, and they'd been fetched back into Sydney and laid up for the duration of the war. And one chap told us very proudly, you see that one, that's Errol Flynn's. Big deal. Well, can't remember whether I saw an Anzac Day parade there. By this time, I think the landings in North Africa had taken place, and we'd said, oh, you know, we thought this was pretty good. We were getting North Africa, Alamein, and so on, coming along, and North Africa getting tidied up after all the row of disasters we'd had in the previous couple of years. And I don't really recall much about Sydney apart from that. Oh, yes, we visited the Long Bar, or the longest bar in the world and so on, which in fact is not a straight long bar, but this one in particular was I think it was either horseshoe or circular. At this time, the 5 o'clock swill was still the prevalent thing in Australia. Licensing hours were such that public houses in Australia were only not open until 5 o'clock, and I think they either closed at 6 or at 6:30. So the dedicated beer drinker in Australia took off like a 100-yard sprinter from work at 5 o'clock when he knocked off, straight into the nearest bar, where the barman or barmen would have the bar lined up with schooners of beer, pints of beer or whatever, glass jars of it, to the number that they normally use, all ready for 5 o'clock, so that when the chaps came in, they threw the money across the counter and started throwing the beer back, which was why it was called the 5 o'clock swill, because, as you know, the Australians have a very nice, elegant turn of phrase to describe most things. Well, we hadn't visited it during that time, but we went in when the first rush was over, because we didn't want to get trampled to death, and we didn't want to get into any arguments with any Australians who were feeling empty about Poms, because it was quite easy, the wrong side of an Aussie who's either not had his beer yet or has had too much. They can be quite cranky devils. Aussies are all right whilst they're insulting you, as long as they do it with a grin, because if they do it with a grin, then you can insult them back and try to beat them at it, as long as you smile. If the Aussies insult you and you lie down under it, they regard you as a dead loss, you're a wimp and so on. They expect you to sling it straight back at them. It's a thing that Americans don't understand. When the Americans see an Australian meet an Englishman and this sets off, you can see the Americans looking really bewildered and puzzled and even worried. They don't realise it's all in the family. There are certain things you have to be a little bit careful, or you had to be a little bit careful about with the digs, otherwise you could push them over the edge. Well, from there we went on to Auckland, across the Tasman Sea. It was only about a week. And we sailed into Auckland Harbour, which is something that everybody should do once in his lifetime, or should have done in those days. I don't know quite what it's like now, coming in from the sea, but it's probably one of the most beautiful harbours in the world, I would think, and the approaches up to Auckland. A couple of islands you pass on the way in. I forget the names now. Roto something or other. And there's the bridge across the gully or canyon or whatever at the back of the town, I can recall. And of course, for anybody out from England after 3 years of blackout and so on, to see Auckland spreading up from the harbour and up the hillside with the bright colours of the house and so on, was a lovely sight. Well, I got ashore there and made my number with the receiving officer and so on, and discovered that the first thing they're going to do with me is to put me on the train. So my travelling days are not yet over. I'm put on the train and shunted straight off down to Wellington, That's a 12, 14-hour journey overnight. Whether it was because of wartime travelling arrangements or simply because that was the way it was always done, the railway journey, the length of the island, always started out in the evening and to arrive at the other end first thing in the morning. So I left Auckland at about, I guess, 6 or 7 o'clock at night to get into Wellington about 6 o'clock in the morning. There was one interesting thing which still happened on those railway journeys in those days. You got to Frankton Junction and the conductor had been round the train taking bookings for dinner. And I looked a bit blank at this, and somebody in the compartment said, oh, you should do it, it's only half a crown, and that's the way it's done, otherwise you'll be hungry, you see. So I dibbed up my half a crown and whatnot and got my little paper ticket. We come into Frankton Junction, and the train stops, everybody gets out, and you go into the dining room at Frankton Junction, and they give you a full dinner. You sit down there, and you eat a dinner, and then you solemnly get aboard the train, and you carry on, very civilised. I thought this was a very nice way to travel. The unfortunate bit about this was that one of the most interesting bits of the journey, where the train climbs a range of hills and down the other side, and I'm told that in daylight you can see the train in three tunnels at once, that kind of, where it winds around the hills. You don't get to see this in the dark. Every time I travelled one way or the other, it was in darkness. The train was, I think it's 3-foot gauge in New Zealand, and that's largely, I guess, because of the nature of the construction required and the hills that they had to get through and the amount of tunnelling necessary. I don't think it's because they bought a cheap lot up second hand from England, as had happened in Australia. Because at that time, in Australia, they still had the different gauges. You come across that, have you? Yep. They had narrow gauge, broad gauge and standard gauge, so that you couldn't travel from Sydney to Perth, for instance, on the same train at that time. You can now, can't you?
I think they've changed it.
It's been changed now. Well, at one time, because they'd... I think when the Great Western line had to change to standard gauge because of the parliamentary gauge being introduced, I think they sold off all their broad gauge stuff to Australia to build a railway there. And I get down to Wellington and I report in and find out that nobody knows who I am, what I am, or what I'm about or anything. And I had to explain that all about it. And having done so, they can't see what use I'm going to be, because they don't think they need oxygen production, because all the oxygen they need for the Air Force they're already getting from a stationary, a commercial oxygen plant in Napier. However, because the son of the owner of that commercial plant is the engineer officer at number one engine repair depot in Hamilton, and because it's number one engine repair depot anyway, and therefore a sort of rather like number one MU in England, it was decided that it would be a good thing if I was posted to Hamilton, because at least the engineer officer there knows something about oxygen plant. And so after a couple of days in Wellington, I was shot off back up to Hamilton. And eventually got... Hamilton doesn't have a railway station. You go into Frankton Junction, again in the same way. And I got from there to a mile and a half down the road, or 2 miles down the road to Hamilton. Made my number there. And I think I'd probably got there ahead of posting from Wellington. I doubt if they'd got the paperwork. So once again I'm in the position of being an unknown quantity arriving.
So this is December 42.
Yeah.
And it's called Number 1 RD.
Number 1 RD, Number 1 Repair Depot. And so the first thing they did was said, well, we don't know who you are, or what you're for, or what to do with you, so you better go on leave. I was due for disembarkation leave anyway, you see. They, this routine of giving you a leave before you go aboard ship for transport and when you come off. And it was suggested that it'd be a good idea. Well, go to Rotorua. You'd want to see Rotorua anyway. You know, everybody who goes to New Zealand has to see Rotorua. So I went to Rotorua and I spent a week there. One of the chaps I'd travelled out with lived in Rotorua, so I made my number with him and was introduced to his family and spent an afternoon with them. And he took me out shooting rabbits and with a 2.2 rifle and so on. I discovered there was a fishing tackle shop in Rotorua, which was run by a chap who came from Kalo, which is a village about a mile and a half outside Chesterfield. In the course of chatting with him, he recognised my accent, and so I was welcome in there. I remember he gave me, he said, have you done any fishing? I said, well, yes, a bit at home, coarse fishing. Oh, not that sort of stuff. He says, you know, what size hooks did you use, and what size tackle? And I told him, oh, he's ridiculous. He says, these are the kind of things we fish with out here. He says, we get trout so big, you know, bragging away like crazy. And he gave me a couple of flies, which he tied and so on. Take these home as samples. Well, I had those as souvenirs for years. Thundering great hooks, which are practically pike hooks as far as I was concerned, but which were apparently normal for the trout fishing they did. The Rotorua in those days was still very empire colonial style. You know, the buildings overlooking the street all had upstairs verandas with a great deal of ornamental cast iron work and so on. Practically every building was corrugated iron roofed. And it was whilst I stayed there that I discovered why they clung to this form of construction. Because I went to the cinema one afternoon. Rather a nice cinema, because they would serve you ice cream whilst you were in there, but not in paper or cardboard cartons and whatnot. Oh no, you could get a banana split and a nice glass dish and so on and eat it in civilised fashion. For about 6 months you got this huge banana split. And in those days the average serviceman was concerned with two things, bed and tucker. You thought I was going to say something else. Some of them were. But remember, I was newly married, very earnest, very intent on keeping things fair and square. Anyway, I'm in this cinema getting my pineapple split and probably watching Fantasia again when the whole thing started heaving and rolling about as though we were at sea, which didn't impress me at all, and I abandoned the banana split and I was outside like a rocket. And so were most other people, but I gathered that this was quite normal for Rotorua, one of their shakes. They got about, you know, if they didn't get one in a day, they wondered what was wrong. And as long as White Island was puffing quite happily off over there, off from Auckland, they reckoned that New Zealand was safe. You've heard of White Island. New Zealand is called White Island the safety valve of the world. As long as White Island's vents are blowing and whatnot, they reckon everywhere else is fairly safe. And when White Island quietens down, then you get problems elsewhere. Well, I don't mind admitting at all being frightened to death by that it wasn't a real earthquake. They only called it a shake. It was enough for me. Well, in the hotel, which the travel company had fixed me up with, there were a couple of folks who I thought were quite old. I suppose they might have been 50, but I thought they were really ancient, you know. And Mr. and Mrs. Percival. And we chatted, and they found, of course, to every New Zealander, every civilian New Zealander at that time, to see an RAF man whom they recognise by his uniform, whilst it looks the same, except when you look at it closely, is different. The cloth is different. The New Zealand uniform is a fine quality serge. Ours was fuzzy, harsh, thick stuff and so on. And, of course, the moment we open our mouths, we don't sound like a New Zealander. You know, I sounded still fairly, I suppose, moderately broad Derbyshire, perhaps broader than I sound now, I hope, or not. They wanted to know who I was, where I was from and so on. Did I know anybody? And it turned out that they were Irish and they'd left Ireland in 1913 and have been in New Zealand ever since. Where are you stationed? Hamilton. Oh, we live in Hamilton. You must come and see us, and so on. And when are you going back? Oh, I'm going back so-and-so, Friday. Oh, we're going back Friday. You travel with us and we can chat, you see. So we get on the train to go back. I still have little mental images of that journey, because I found out that my eyes were sore, and then by the time we got on the train and whatnot, they were very sore, and Mrs. Percival saw me rubbing my eyes, wanted to know what the score was, and she diagnosed it as conjunctivitis. Apparently something not too uncommon. You pick it up in that area, I think. Anyway, she told me what it was, what not to do, don't touch it, don't rub it, and so on. Suffer it as best you can. And she said, come home with me and I'll give you some treatment straight away. She'd been a nurse at one time, or done some nursing, and so she treated it with silver nitrate drops, which I gather is not the treatment used today, but nevertheless it worked beautifully well and cleared it up. And so after that I was invited whenever I had 24 hours off or 48 hours to go and stay with them. One of their sons was in the New Zealand 3rd Division waiting to go up into the islands. He was artillery. And another of their sons was in Italy, I think in New Zealand 2nd Division. I think he was not in Italy by that time. He'd been in North Africa, and before I came away he was in Italy. They quite liked having a young bud like myself about the house. And Mr. Percival had they lived opposite the entrance to what was known in Hamilton as the Demesne. In Chesterfield, or in England, we'd have called it the town park. There was a large lake there which was used for dinghy sailing and things of that order, and of course the usual walks around it and so on, a recreation area. Just outside the gate, Mr. Percival had a filling station, petrol filling station, so he managed to keep a car trundling about, although petrol rationing was fairly strict. And at first we were billeted in the town of Hamilton, in a little place just outside the town on the south side of town called Snake Gully. Right. The huts in which we were billeted were the cheapest huts you can imagine. They were, I suppose, made by some firm which had made garden sheds before the war. The timber was was tongue and groove boarding, simply creosoted, and it was of the lightest thickness that you'd normally have, and they were just big enough to accommodate 4 service beds with a little space between the foot, 2 and 2 end on, and the space between 2 beds was the width of the doorway, which gives you the floor size of the hut, because the hut itself in width was little more than the width of 3 beds, which gives you about 6'9", 7 feet across the floor by the length of 2 beds plus a doorway. And the wood was so green that once the sheds had been erected and the roofs were proofed with roofing felt, once the huts had been standing in the sun for a little while, the wood shrank, and it was quite possible to lie in bed in the hut and look outside through the gaps between the tongue and groove boarding where the boarding had shrunk. And when you bear in mind that in winter in Hamilton it's possible to have several degrees of frost overnight and 70 degrees at midday on with all the, within the same 24 hours, you'll appreciate that the provision of a little stove in the centre of these huts was quite necessary for winter. The only problem was finding the fuel to feed the stove. Anyway, there, after we'd been down there for a little while, I was made up to sergeant, because by this time the two mobile plant had arrived in town, and a whole load of packing cases containing my stationary gear. And it was then that I discovered that all this gear had been intended for Siletta, because the packing cases were so marked, stenciled. And I'd gone into the orderly room there and pointed out that the intention had been that I was to come out wherever I was posted. I was to be NCOIC these plants, and that each plant would have a corporal in charge and an operating crew, and I'd be the NCOIC this lot and train them. It was obviously going to be my job to install the stationary plant, and therefore if I was going to have corporals and be in charge of corporals, I had to be a sergeant. So wasn't it about time they made me up? Well, how long have you been a corporal, and so on and so on. And I give them the old griff, and all right, you're a sergeant. So I move out of Snake Gully into the into the part of the camp where the billets were in the centre of town, quite close to the gasworks, which has now gone. And I'm now in the sergeant's mess, and then. And exactly, the huts are exactly the same, but they're now sergeant's huts in town centre. And I have the job now of beginning to sort out these two plants and sort out the equipment for the stationary plant. Well, unfortunately, the handbooks or manufacturer's books for the stationary plant and the assembly drawings, general assembly drawings and whatnot, are not with it. So there now begins a correspondence with Air House in New Zealand to try to find out where all the information is about this stationary plant. Well, the usual replies come at first: we don't know anything about it. After 3 or 4 months, we discover that there is an RAF pilot officer down in Air House in Wellington who has all this stuff, and he's been using it on his desk and in his office to make it look as though he's